Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the Q&A session, you may press star then one on your touch-tone phone if you would like to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I'd like to turn the meeting over to Mr. Andrew Schmidt, Linux for System Z, ISV Program Manager. You may begin.
Thank you, Mike. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on where you all are. It's a worldwide call. I'm sure we have people from virtually every continent in the world, and appreciate you taking time out on your calendar schedule today to participate in our first half of 2012 Linux distribution update call. Today we're going to be having a presentation from SUSE concerning Linux on System Z distribution, and I know, again, that I and they appreciate your attendance. Now, the slides have been posted for a couple of days on the SUSE website. Hopefully, most of you got the email yesterday that was sent out that had the URL for that, but just in case, I will give it a couple of times in a few seconds, so pick up a pencil if you need to do that. And I'll give you a couple of seconds to write that down. Today, our presenter is Olaf Kurisch. And he's the Director of Server Engineering. He'll be speaking, I believe he's in Germany. And we have a number of other people from SUSE on the line today that will participate in the Q&A that we'll have at the end if need be. And I appreciate Mikey, Patrick, Kay, and Marcus's attendance for that as well. This call, as Mike said, will be recorded, and we will be posting it on the SUSE website for playback if you'd like to re-listen or share it with your colleagues at your enterprise in a few days. So that URL, just in case you don't have it, is www.suse.com/partners, that's plural, P-A-R-T-N-E-R-S, /IBM. And the presentation can be seen by scrolling down to the bottom under Joint Solutions, and then there is a link to the ISV presentation. Again, that's www.suse.com/partners/IBM, and then find the section at the bottom of that page called Joint Solutions, and click on the link. So without any further ado, I'll pass it off to Olaf, and there are page numbers on the slides he'll be referring to on an occasional basis, and I look forward to your presentation, Olaf. Thank you.
Okay. Andrew, thank you very much. Welcome to my presentation. Today I'm trying to give you a little bit of an overview of how we built SUSE Linux Enterprise Service Packs at SUSE, and have a particular focus on our kernel here. The occasion why we are doing this is, of course, we updated the Linux kernel to a 3.0 kernel in our Service Pack 2 for SUSE Linux Enterprise 11. And certainly that requires a little bit of explanation. And with this presentation today, I'm trying to give you a little bit of a background here of where we're coming from, what this implies, and so on, and what the actual differences are, and how this affects you as our customers. So, we're on slide 4 now. And in terms of a background, I would like to talk a little bit about what actually shapes a service pack for SUSE Linux Enterprise, and what forces actually pull on our kernel in a variety of different directions as we start to build the service pack. So slide 5, one of the biggest factors that is affecting us here is hardware enablement. We're trying to release service packs every 16 to 18 months, roughly. And every time we do this, there's, of course, a lot of new hardware that gets released by our IHV partners, and we want to make sure that our customers are actually able to use our operating system on that hardware, so we have to make sure we're getting all the support in there. A lot of different areas are affected, and I'm going to come to those in a moment. At the same time, there is demand for certain new functionality. So, for instance, one request that we've been hearing a lot in the past is, for instance, support for fiber channel over Ethernet, so everything around fabric convergence has been a very strong influence for our past couple of service packs. other things include, for instance, changes in NFS, so improved support for NFS V4 or even parallel NFS. Things like that are actually always a big force when it comes to the decision of what actually goes into the next enterprise kernel. Contrary to that, there's also forces that slow us down. So we can't just take everything and say, yeah, you be happy. But one of the biggest things for ISVs is, in fact, interface stability. So, of course, from an ISV perspective, the most important aspect of interface stability is at the level of shared libraries and application interfaces, APIs. But also, to some degree, there is a question of kernel interface stability. So especially if you have applications that interact closely with the kernel, that use proc files, sys files, and whatever. And the other force that is somewhat counter to this, you know, all the new functionality kind of thing, is, of course, robustness and performance. When we create our original SUSE Linux Enterprise kernel for a new major version, we spend a lot of time on hardening it and on making sure the performance is at least as good as it was before, if we can't even improve it. Okay? And so if we just dump any random new functionality into the kernel, we're risking all of that. So we have to be very discreet and think very hard about what kind of functionality we want to pull in and how it affects the performance, how it affects the stability, and so on. So these are the kind of the four major forces that impact what kind of features we put into the next service pack and the ones we let out. So I'm on slide 9 now. The way we arrive at these decisions is, of course, a technical one based on these four forces I just enumerated. Some of these changes on which we decide are, of course, as I mentioned, requirements from upcoming hardware, new CPUs, chipsets, and so on. Sometimes even entire new subsystems like we had with the SP2 kernel. Lots of people actually needed support for USB 3.0. So there's an entire stack that we actually need to include here. There are customer requests that we receive that indicate there's a very strong need for this and that technology. For instance, what we're seeing is IPv6 picking up quite strongly, so we're seeing a lot of requests in that area coming towards us. That we have to balance against the other constraints as well. Another source of these changes is innovative work happening in the upstream kernel. I mentioned Fibre Channel over Ethernet or the ButterFS file system. We looked at the different file systems options that were there and found that ButterFS actually was the most promising one in terms of the future potential it has. And so that's why we looked at this very closely and eventually decided to pick ButterFS. And all of these things are actually going into our considerations of which features we include. And these changes as a whole, they can be quite a lot of them, and some of them are quite massive. So enabling a new chipset on the motherboard, whatever, is probably not such an intrusive exercise. But fiber channel over Ethernet support, for instance, is huge. It's not just FCOE itself, but because it's being developed upstream, it's being developed against the latest block layer, which means there is a lot of dependencies on the new functionality. And so it's not just a one-to-one mapping of you take that driver and you put it into that slash kernel. I'm on slide 10. The following slides kind of work best when I click through them while I'm talking. So since we don't have any central control over the slides, you have to do the clicking yourself while I keep talking here. To give you an idea about the scope of change that we have. I'm trying to put up this little graphic here showing you what kind of components actually change in each service pack. So we're on slide 11. We're including fixes for a variety of subsystems like NFS, for instance, or specific file systems like EXT3 and so on. There is things like 4K sector support. More and more drives actually have an internal sector size of 4K in System X, for instance. And being able to cope with this and align data nicely requires some changes in the kernel and elsewhere. We've got lots of new drivers, like E1000 is one of those that always gets updated. Some of these driver changes are a little more massive. So, for instance, in the InfiniBand area, it's not just one or two drivers. It's a whole ecosystem of stuff from the OFET distribution. And this one is a little bit notorious in our engineering teams because it's not really one of the most trivial things to incorporate into a release. Moving on, we've got various virtualization solutions, various hypervisors. We're talking about a wireless stack update every now and then because that is still a very... It's an area that evolves very quickly. So even there, it's not just single drivers. It's always connected to some changes to the stack. Same goes for video. That is also something that is undergoing massive change, especially in the X systems, because all these graphics vendors are really going crazy, throwing out new hardware by the week. And getting that enabled means adopting new drivers and so on at a very fast pace. A lot of stuff is happening there. Moving on, we've got multipath changes. That's one of the staple items. We've got maybe VMware support, new drivers in the host adapter area. We've always carry some SystemZ enhancements with every release. Actually, we're sometimes incorporating these enhancements even between releases if they're benign enough to actually carry as a maintenance update. Going on, we've got IPv6 firewalling. We had scheduler improvements, rate changes, OCFS2 bug fixes, and whatever. And I could probably still go on for another 10 minutes just listing all these individual areas inside the kernel that we're touching with these service packs. I'm on slide 16 now. Now, you may be wondering, given this big number of areas that we're touching, how do we make all of this work and make it work well? So next slide, slide 17. What we're starting with, this big green box that you're seeing, this is essentially the previous SUSE Linux Enterprise kernel. So this is what we're starting with, and this is what we're adding functionality to. In the standard model that we've been using for a very long time and very successfully, we're backporting functionality from mainline. So we're not doing any custom development. We're not asking our partners to deliver custom drivers for our kernel, but we make sure everything we accept into the next service pack is upstream in a mainline kernel. We take it from there and backport it. The reason for that is that we believe the most stable source of code is upstream. It gets tested there a lot. People use it there. If we get our custom driver, it's something that may not be as well tested or as stable as something that has gone through mainline and has been there for a couple of iterations. That's our motivation there, and it also means that we're not diverging completely, because as we add more and more patches to a SLES kernel, the harder it becomes, for instance, to include critical bug fixes, critical security fixes, or whatever, from upstream and merge them into our kernel. So the more we try to mimic what is upstream, the less we get into trouble when we later have to backport patches. So backport support include selected enhancements, like I mentioned for NFS V4. It also includes hardware enablement and essentially all these areas that you've seen before. And then we apply our engineering processes to it. That's shown in the next slide. We call it our SUSE quality engineering. And what that means is we're not just taking these patches, you know, stick them to the kernel with a little bit of glue or duct tape, but we actually make sure we integrate them well, we QA them, we actually validate that they're not breaking the interfaces in any way. We're making sure that they're secure, that they perform well. All of that together is the actual added value that we provide in including this functionality. This is what makes the SLE kernel a stable kernel rather than something that falls apart when you start using it. And the result of that is the next SUSE Linux 11 service pack kernel, all of that taken together. I'm on slide 19 now. Moving on to 21. So we've been doing the same. We've been doing this approach for SLE 11 SP2 as well. When we started planning Service Pack 2 a little over a year ago now, we received about 8,000 individual feature requests from partners, from customers, some of them internal from engineering, some of them internal from product management. Of course, there is a certain overlap. So for some commonly used drivers like the E1000, we receive the request to update to the latest upstream version from a number of partners. So the overall number is slightly lower than that, but still the overlap is not so substantial. So it is really a huge number of individual feature requests that we have to evaluate, go through, check out before we make a decision of what's in and what isn't. The majority of those is really in the kernel area. It was slightly more than usual, I have to say. So I don't have the numbers for Service Pack 1, but for SP1, SP2, it's usually a lot that we receive. For SP3 and 4, it's usually a bit less. But this time around, it was substantial, and the changes that were being requested were almost all across the map. So there were requests to include the latest scheduler from the upstream, from the mainline kernel, because of certain performance characteristics on a variety of platforms. In order to support FCOE and the latest improvements in iSCSI, I alluded to that before, we had to backport most of the block layer from mainline. There were a number of changes and improvement in virtual memory management that we were asked to backport, which resulted in a huge number of patches. As I said, USB 3.0 required backporting the entire USB stack. We introduced ButterFS as a supported file system. But still, we tried to do that the, I would say, traditional way by backporting all that functionality to 2.6.32. I'm on slide 22 now. And by the time we reached beta 4, we were almost done with incorporating all these feature changes. There were a few of them still missing, but that's not because our guys were lazy or anything, but simply because some upstream functionality wasn't as mature as it was supposed to be. It was a tough challenge, but we succeeded. We persevered. The teams worked very hard on stabilizing this kernel. We ran all the performance tests we usually do. We eliminated all the performance issues that we found. And the result was actually a kernel that we would have shipped. It was good. It was the usual quality criteria were met. It was performing well. And we proved that this approach of backporting works. And it was a kernel that we could have been proud of. So the SUSE labs and the kernel people there did great work. But still, we stepped back for a moment and said, is this really the best thing we can do? I'm on slide 23 now. the problems we were seeing was just the huge amount of changes that we were being asked to do this time. And mind you, out of these 8,000 feature requests we received, of course we do not accept all of them. There is a lot of stuff that gets plain rejected. There is a lot of stuff that gets deferred to a future release or to SLES 12 or whatever. Still, the number of change requests we received and the amount of dependent backports that we had to do, like I mentioned, in the block I.O. layer, resulted in a pretty massive change. So as of beta 4, we had added 12,500 patches on top of what was in Service Pack 1. 12,500 patches is a lot. We don't have 12,000 developers, not by far, right? So these guys have been working really, really hard. It was twice the number of code lines being changed compared to what we did before. And if you look at the chart on page 24 and on slide 24, we were actually, we're looking here at the number of files changed. You can also see what a massive and intrusive modification of the kernel Service Pack 2 was. Okay. We could have been more conservative. We could have actually said, no, we're not honoring all these feature requests from our partners and from our customers. But we would have had some very unhappy partners and customers in that case. So we decided to go with what we had and honor these feature requests. But we looked at the result and said, well, it's actually a Franken kernel. I'm on page 25. And this Franken kernel, it's got a little problem. So it works for now, but what happens if we actually need to add more functionality on top of that? So consider something like parallel NFS that was also requested by a number of partners and that some people are urgently asking for. It would have meant backporting another 700 patches on top of that. We had to leave out a number of virtualization improvements. RADOS, which is a distributed cloud storage solution, which we're actually evaluating, wasn't even on the map by that time, but it would have been terrible. And given that we're just at Service Pack 2, and we're looking at a lifetime of Service Pack 3, Service Pack 4, and beyond, we didn't feel that we were in a position with that kernel to make anybody happy. Not our support organization, not our backline engineers who would have to fix bugs, nor our customers and partners come Service Pack 3 or 4, and we have to say, sorry, this one, we can't extend this anymore. So we decided to do better. Now, stepping back a little bit, we tried to remind ourselves what was our original motivation for this model. Why did we decide that when we do a major release, we pick a kernel and we stick to it all the way to the end? Why did we do it? And that actually goes back in history quite some time. So SUSE actually did the first enterprise Linux about 10 years ago. We were the first ones to actually release an enterprise Linux distribution with an enterprise kernel. And at that time, the development in the Linux world, in the kernel world, was quite different from what it was today. There was a so-called stable kernel branch. At that time, it was the 2.2 kernel, and there was a development branch. And all the exciting development, all the new stuff happened in the development branch, but unfortunately, it was broken more often than it was working. So it wasn't uncommon for things to stop working completely for a number of patch levels. It was actually accepted if the next big rewrite of the virtual memory system makes the kernel unbootable on 50% of all machines and whatever. That happened all the time, and of course, that is not a good basis for an enterprise distribution. So with that model, all enterprise distros were sticking to this stable kernel branch anyway, and there was a lot of backporting to be done because all the new stuff happened in 2.3 and had to be backported to 2.2 anyway. And the same goes for later stages where we had 2.4 and 2.5. So this is where this paradigm of stable kernel with backports came from. This is where it originated. But that has changed. So with the release of the 2.6 kernel, the community picked a very different approach. Nowadays, there is just one branch. There is no stable and unstable or anything. There is one branch of kernel development, and there is a lot of focus on stability nowadays. For a very long time, there has not been that sort of breakage that we have been seeing in the development kernels. And Linus and Andrew Morton and a bunch of other people are doing a great job there to make sure that the quality of the kernel is adequate when they release. And it's a very, very tough regime that they're running there, but it's actually a very successful one. What we found is that because of the stability of the 2.6 kernels compared to the old development branches, on these kernels, actually taking one of these upstream kernels and turning that into an enterprise product, an enterprise-ready kernel, it's still considerable work, but it's feasible, and the amount of effort we have to put in there is actually not much different than we had to do for creating this Franken kernel. So there is a certain distance to be traveled, but the delta is not as big as it used to be 5 years ago. So we decided to go with the latest mainline kernel instead of patching on top of 2.6.32. As a big coincidence, Linus at that time decided he wanted to have some kind of birthday present for 20 years of Linux and decided to rename the current upstream mainline kernel into 3.0. From our point of view, there's not much magic in there. So the 3.0 kernel is not much different from the 2.6.38 or 39 kernel. It's just got a different version number because Linus wanted it that way. But it was kind of a funny coincidence that now we're releasing a 3.0 kernel. Others have decided to also release a 3.0 kernel, but call it 2.6.40 to cloak that fact. But essentially, 3.0 is in and out of itself 2.6.40. It's just a continuation of what had been there. It's the natural evolution. So the version number is not a big deal for us, but still, it's kind of cool. We're proud to present you Linux 3.0. It's a cool message, I think. We're on page 28 now, moving on to the next one. Now, looking at what does that mean for you as the customer, what are you getting? What's different? Does that change mean a lot? Does it mean a little? And so for that reason, I would like to compare the effort that we've done in creating this patched SP2 kernel versus the backport, versus the 3.0-based one. On the upper left-hand corner, you see basically the image I've shown you before. The new kernel would have been 2.6.32-based, with hardware enablement, with selected enhancements, and we've been looking to maintain stable interfaces. We made it robust. We ran all the performance tests. So this is what you're used to. Page 30, when we're looking at Linux 3.0, all the hardware enablement and all the new functionality is there. It comes with the upstream kernel. There's no effort involved in there for us. It's just, it exists. We take it. There's no backporting involved. But still, we add our SUSE quality engineering here, what I call it. And slide 32 now, what that means is we spend a lot of time on making sure that the interfaces are stable. So on a kernel level, when you're talking about stable interfaces, of course, the one thing that comes to mind immediately is the system calls. But that is sort of the easiest aspect. System calls are kind of sacrosanct, even in the mainline community, and everybody's paying great attention to not changing anything there. But there's a lot of other stuff at the barrier, at the interface between userland and the kernel that constitutes the overall behavior. So there are virtual files like the proc file system or the sys file system that export kernel internal interfaces or data to userland, and there are utilities that rely on certain formats or certain locations of the data to access it. There's I/O controls that have specific numbers that take data that is present in specific structs and is laid out in a certain form. There are things like DRM, which is used in the graphics area, which has a lot of userland, kernelland interfaces, and so on. And all of that we evaluated and made sure that we're not changing anything. In parentheses, except where it was really not relevant. Next slide. The other two things that we applied just as usual is tuning, making sure the performance is up to par, and looking at the robustness, running stability tests, making sure it behaves just like you would expect it to. And funnily enough, we had to do a number of forward ports instead of back ports. Those were few and in between, but we had a few examples of those. For instance, if in the upstream kernel, certain functionality got deprecated. For instance, there was a certain version of the squash file system, which is used to compress data as you store it on a file system. It's usually, we use it for building our DVD, our installation images on DVDs, but some customers actually use it for data archiving. So, for instance, in the financial industry, where you have these legal obligations to basically record everything you do and retain that information for a million years, these people sometimes use SquashFS, and of course they would be very unhappy if they actually record everything and all of a sudden next year they can't read it anymore. So for those people, we were forward porting SquashFS and two or three other cases. So that sums up what we did with a Linux 3.0 kernel. The overall picture you can see on slide 35. This is pretty much, it looks pretty much like what we've done before, with the exception of now, instead of doing a lot of backports, we have been doing some forward ports. Now, what does that mean for you? The bottom line message here is that we're delivering the quality that you are used to, plus we're able to give you a lot more innovation than we have been able to do before. So rather than being very selective about what we can provide you, being caught between these four forces, the two forces that actually propel us forward and the other two forces that keep us down and actually dictate how much change we can allow in these patched kernels, we can now essentially give you everything that's in upstream. You don't have to, in SP2, you don't have to ask for this and that specific functionality from upstream. If it's there, it's there. So slide 38. The bottom line is what we give you in the kernel is we guarantee interface stability. We give you a kernel that is robust because we tested it and our partners tested it a lot. We give you support for the latest hardware. We did that yesterday and we do it today. We support and provide the features that you in an enterprise environment request from us, and we're tuning our kernels for top performance. And that is actually no matter on which kernel version. The bottom line here is we could do it by backporting, and we can do it today by taking the latest upstream kernel. And we proved that with Service Pack 2. So, with that, I'm open to hearing your questions. I'm certainly willing to explain more things if there's interest in specific areas. Andrew, I'm handing back to you for now.
Okay, well, if I believe that Mike will now open up the lines for questions and answers. Mike?
Yes, thank you. To ask a question, you may please press star then one on your touchtone phone. Please unmute your phone and record your first and last name clearly when prompted. To withdraw your question, please press star then two. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one and record your name. One moment, please, for our first question. It appears we have no questions at this time.
Okay, Olaf, that must mean you've done a great job explaining the material today. We do also have the ability, of course, that if people were shy about asking a question or they want to ask a question later because they reviewed the material and something came up later on or what have you, feel free, of course, to send me an email to our generic department ID, zisvq@us.ibm.com, or my email address that most people know from the note that you received yesterday. But again, our generic department ID is zisvq@us.ibm.com, and we'll certainly get that off to Olaf if you have questions. I'd like to thank Olaf for his presentation this morning, as well as you for attending the first half of our 2012-year Linux distribution update. And as I said earlier in the preamble, note that the replay will be available on the SUSE website probably by the middle of next week, I would expect. We look forward to seeing you again on our next Linux distribution partner call in the future. Thanks very much, and have a good weekend.
This concludes today's call. You may disconnect at this time. Once again, this concludes today's call. You may disconnect at this time. Thank you.